McGregor when you already will start. Hedging conspiracy, you mean? Okay, Manuel, welcome. Properly dressed, I'm glad to see you.
Thanks, David.
You didn't hear, though.
You have to maintain the standards, don't we?
Yes, you do. Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Turning to agenda paper 11A. It's just an overview of the papers that we're going to be discussing today. We'll be talking about three main areas, presentation, disclosure, and classification today. In terms of how this fits into the timetable, if you turn to Appendix A, we were planning to discuss a couple of more topics this month, but unfortunately we've had to push them out until next month. Hopefully we should still be on track to getting the final amendment finalized by the first quarter of 2011. If it's okay with the board, I'll probably start with the papers on disclosure. We've got three papers discussing disclosure. Agenda paper 11E, 11F, and 11G. Agenda paper 11E sets out the board's approach and discusses the disclosure objectives. Agenda paper 11F discusses the new disclosures that the board proposed in the exposure draft, and agenda paper 11G discusses any other disclosures that were in the exposure draft that people commented on, and also any disclosures that comment letters have suggested the board look into. Starting from agenda paper 11E, just to give you a brief overview of what the responses in the comment letters were to the board's approach to disclosures in the exposure draft. In developing the proposed disclosures in the exposure draft, the board's approach was one that to achieve entities providing sufficient disclosures when the defined benefit plans are material to the entity, but to ensure that relevant information is not obscured by excessive detail as well. In following this approach, the board sought to set out the objectives and then support those objectives with detailed disclosure requirements. Many respondents were concerned that the proposed disclosures in the exposure draft would still give rise to excessive detailed and voluminous disclosures in annual reports. A lot of respondents believe that supplementing the objectives with an extensive list of these disclosure requirements would lead to a type of one-size-fits-all set of requirements that might not be flexible enough to adjust to an entity's individual circumstances. These respondents suggested a more principles-based approach to disclosure, putting the emphasis more on the disclosure objectives and less on the detailed requirements following those objectives. For instance, by using words other than an entity shall disclose this, such as an entity is encouraged to disclose this, or by providing providing the disclosures as examples of how an entity might meet the disclosure objectives. Other commentators suggested that the board provide more guidance or some discussion of how materiality applies to the disclosures in the exposure draft. Some suggested some discussion along the lines of what was in paragraph 70 of the exposure draft revenue. However, on the flip side of having a more principles-based disclosure, a lot of people were concerned about having disclosure requirements that were too high level because the disclosure requirements that are too high level will result in boilerplates or very generic type of disclosures. We did discuss this approach with the Employee Benefits Working Group when we met them on the 27th of September. There was no objection from the members of the group to the overall approach that we took in the exposure draft. However, members did note that it is difficult for preparers and auditors to determine the appropriate level of disclosure in terms of and applying materiality to those requirements. Now, in terms of our analysis and view, we don't think the board previously decided not to include any specific materiality guidance in the disclosure proposals. However, we do think that there probably is some scope for including some discussion along the lines of what was included in the revenue ED. But we will continue to monitor what feedback the board is going to be getting on the other disclosure proposals that are out there at the moment. And if anything useful comes up, we'll be sure to take that into account when finalising the amendments. But we're not suggesting anything specific at the moment. Turning to the disclosure objectives themselves, the exposure draft proposed that three disclosure objectives that meant you should disclose information that explains the characteristics of the entity's defined benefit plans, that identifies and explains the amounts in the financial statements that arise from those plans, and to describe how defined benefit plans affect the amounts, timing and variability of the entity's future cash flows. There was quite a lot of support for the disclosure objectives in the comment letters. However, some respondents stated that the board should be making more of a specific mention of risk in the objectives, given this was part of the reason why the board wanted to improve the disclosures, to improve the information about risk. We think that the information about risk is probably the disclosure objectives cover information about risk. However, we think we could potentially better articulate the disclosure objectives and to provide a better link between the disclosure objectives and the disclosure requirements supporting those objectives when it comes to risk. For instance, we have one requirement to disclose information about the risks that arise because of participation of a plan, of an entity in a plan. And we have that disclosure requirement as supporting disclosure objective A, which is, you know, explaining the characteristics. But we also have the disclosure requirements about the sensitivity analysis supporting the disclosure objective C, describing how the defined benefit plans affect the amount, time and variability of cash flow. So we think there's probably scope there to better integrate the disclosure objectives and the requirements relating to risk and to better communicate that. But we still think that the disclosure objectives themselves cover the issue of risk adequately. Our recommendation is that the board confirms the disclosure objectives in the ED. However, of course, there may be some redrafting necessary.
Very cool. Now, before we discuss the detailed disclosure proposals in the coming papers, can I get a clear answer from you? You know, you raised in these papers about the concerns whether those disclosure proposed or required in this standard will be mandatory at all, or whether in the future the actual disclosure will be boilerplate type of disclosure. As I understand, the disclosure requirements requiring all of our standards, some of them may be, you know, mandatory, some of them may be dependent on the entity-specific environment. Otherwise, I always have the big concerns we require too much. And last month, we accept the IFRIC proposal not go further the original ideas to cut our the previous disclosure requirement in particular standards into mandatory ones or not, because it's hard to make a judgment. Now, my question to you is, the disclosure requirement either in this standards or in other standards will not be mandatory at all. Am I right?
Sorry, just so I understand the question, are you asking whether the disclosure proposals in the exposure draft, would they be mandatory or not? I think the way that they are written, they're written mandatory, of course, to the extent that they're material.
And they apply to the entity.
Yeah.
That's what he's asking.
Do they apply
to the entity or not? Do you need to disclose, or do you need to apply only if they apply to the entity with materiality? That's what his question is.
Well, it's
always those who apply.
Yeah, it has to be.
It has to apply to the entity.
As it is applicable to the entity and if it's material.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not exactly.
This is what I want to ask you.
And I think the issue that the IFRIC had looked at that was particularly troublesome was when it was described as encouraged but not required. And I don't think that's what's being proposed here at all.
Yeah. We're not suggesting the board change its approach, the general approach that it took in the exposure draft to set out the disclosure objectives and follow that on with the disclosure requirements. So we're not suggesting we change that at this point in time.
Paul, you want to comment?
My recollection of what IFRIC looked at was where there are some encouraged disclosures, is anybody doing it? Mm-hmm. And I think they found nobody's doing it. I don't see how we can encourage things. Either it's a good disclosure and it's required if it's in the entity circumstances or not. I think that I would not support encouraged disclosure.
You would encourage that we don't encourage.
I encourage that we don't encourage.
Well, just as a reminder, the encouraged disclosures are all relics from the past, and this board has had a policy for probably 7 or 8 years of not putting in encouraged disclosures. They're either required or they're not in there.
Okay, can we return to the...
So, can I ask a clarifying question regarding the paragraph 13? So, you said that in here, paragraph 70 of the revenue recognition exposure draft type of...
I assume you have to speak up.
Oh.
Which paper is that?
It's 11D. 11D, I think. Still, we are in 11D, I think.
Yeah.
Are you awake? No. Sorry. Paragraph 13.11E, paragraph 13. So I'm not quite sure if you're watching sort of the paragraph 70 of the revenue recognition ED condition type of the ones, you would include But
paragraph 70 of the revenue exposure draft states an entity shall consider the level of detail necessary to satisfy the disclosure requirements and how much emphasis to place on each of the various requirements.
Yes.
And I think that's quite helpful because materiality tends to be an on-off switch. It doesn't really help you determine to what extent you should be disclosing in accordance with paragraph X or in accordance with paragraph Y. So having some discussion, if that helps people get over that hurdle of, you know, in producing something that's scalable to what
they're asking. I understand that point, but my question is that now this project is should be complete by March 2011, I think, but by that time, revenue recognition projects will not be completed, I think. So what is your plan?
I'm not going to link up the disclosures, but we are going to try and get them as consistent as possible across the project. So I'll just keep monitoring what kind of feedback we get, for instance, on this paragraph. If respondents think that, you know, it works. Because people have suggested that we include something similar in this exposure, as part of these amendments. So if people think that it's helpful, then why not include it?
I think this is very useful.
Yeah.
So,
but I'm not going to, yes, I'm not suggesting we'll wait until we complete all the disclosure requirements, then we deal with it.
Irrespective of the completion of the revenue recognition, we should consider to take into this paragraph into account here.
Yeah.
In terms of process, how are you going to manage the feedback, obtaining feedback on those revised proposals? We are not going to re-expose anything, I guess. So, to a certain extent, this stems out of discussion with the employee benefit working group, which is good. But how are you going to ascertain that we get enough feedback from other parts before we finalize? Because this timetable does not allow for any additional roundtables or whatever. So are you going to have direct outreach to some user groups to test the revised proposals for disclosures? Or?
Well, it depends. It depends where we end up on disclosures. Number one, if we end up somewhere completely different from what we had in the exposure draft, then we're probably going to have to think about it. But I think we should probably just go through today and see where we end up first, and then we'll have to think about it afterwards.
Okay, can we look at the question that's been put at the end of 21? Most people supported the objectives. Do we agree with that? Anyone disagree? Okay, what about the point that Tatsumi raised, which is the paragraph 70? You say you're going to put in something like that. I don't think it has to be the same, but the disclosure framework also does something like that. It says you really should paint the picture, never mind all the detail. It's the picture that you have to paint. And materiality doesn't work, as we discovered when we were in Australasia. Unfortunately, people put everything in because the regulator says, why haven't you done X? It isn't material. Prove it. They have to do it anyway. Or they're rushing to get the year-end accounts out, and they just did what they did last year and just keep going. So materiality isn't very good for disclosures. The one issue that we actually cut down the disclosures a lot that went an exposure out of. I remember we had Jan leading the attack from the preparers and the defence from the Pats and Steve, where we had a discussion about what should be there. And even yet, we've been told it's voluminous, so we have to have a look at that when we do it. The paragraph 70, I think, is key. Okay, can we go on to the next paper? I'm going to ask you how this ties up with the US disclosures when we finish, so if you bear that in mind, Manuel, what FASB does.
Okay.
Okay.
So, so moving on to agenda paper 11F, as I mentioned, this paper deals with the additional disclosures that the board proposed in the exposure draft, and sought and the exposure draft asked a specific question on those being information about risk and sensitivity analysis, disclosures about demographic assumptions, disclosure of alternative measures of the defined benefit obligation, information about asset liability matching strategy, and information about the factors that would cause service costs to differ from contributions. I'm going to run through all of these at once, and then we'll take questions at the end, if that's okay. Starting from the disclosure about risk and sensitivity analysis. Most respondents were quite supportive of having the disclosures about risk. However, they were a bit worried about requiring these disclosures of all risks, all material and significant risks. They thought it would result in very large, voluminous disclosures that wouldn't be particularly useful. Some respondents suggested that we should be looking to limit this disclosure to items that are specific or unusual to the plan. For instance, you know, examples of disclosures that that respondents brought up when discussing this was stuff about the plan being exposed to longevity risk and the plan actually being exposed to market risk and whether we should be requiring entities to disclose really all of the risks that that they're exposed to or just the ones that are specific or unusual. Regarding the sensitivity analysis, there was very little support for this. Part of the reason why I think there was various levels of support is there was a bit of, I think, confusion over what the objective of this sensitivity analysis was. It wasn't that clear from the exposure draft whether the sensitivity analysis was for the purpose of communicating risk or whether it was for the purpose of communicating measurement uncertainty. It did feature in the disclosures under the heading supporting the objective about the amount, timing and uncertainty of cash flows. So I think probably it has more to do about risks. However, that wasn't that clear in the exposure draft. And therefore, we got various responses from respondents, which really, I think, viewed it from two different perspectives. Some of the concerns that respondents raised with the sensitivity analysis included the lack of the sensitivity on the plan assets to complement the sensitivity on the DBO, the lack of taking into account correlations between interrelated assumptions when doing the sensitivity. There were also concerns about needing the or concerns about the lack of specificity, which people thought would not help comparability in terms of identifying specifically which assumptions they should be performing their sensitivity on, and also the quantum range they should be using for the sensitivity. Some respondents suggested that we should limit the sensitivity to just the discount rate. They thought that was the most significant assumption. There were some that were concerned about the role of sensitivity analysis in financial reporting in general. They didn't really see it as a financial statement disclosure. They see it more of a management commentary type of disclosure. And some people thought that it wasn't consistent with the measurement of the DBO in IS 19 because the DBO is based on management's single best estimates, and therefore the range of estimates shouldn't be disclosed because it might contradict the management's best estimate. We talked about this at the Employee Benefits Working Group as well, and we talked about the two objectives of a sensitivity analysis, that being, you know, either risk or measurement uncertainty. Many members of the working group were concerned about the lack of requirement to require correlations within the actuarial assumptions being used to derive the sensitivity. However, they were concerned that it would only be useful for sophisticated users with an actuarial background. Moving on to the staff analysis on this specific issue, we agree with the views that we shouldn't be requiring disclosure of every single risk that the defined benefit plan exposes the entity to, and therefore we recommend limiting that disclosure to the unusual or specific risks to the entity. In terms of the sensitivity analysis, what we've looked at, we've looked at the following issues. Number one, whether entities should provide sensitivity analysis on the NETs or on the DBO. Whether to require entities to provide sensitivity analysis on the service costs, in addition to the defined benefit obligation. Whether to limit the possible actuarial assumptions, perhaps the discount rate or another set, and whether to specify the range that will require sensitivity. In terms of excluding plan assets from the sensitivity, we don't think that the comment letters raised any issues that invalidate what the board has already thought about in terms of the difficulty of providing that information. In terms of the service costs, we agreed with the views in the comment letters that providing sensitivity on service costs based on what was possible at the beginning of the period wouldn't make a lot of sense and would not be particularly useful. And therefore, we recommend the board drop that from the requirements. In terms of whether we should limit the actuarial assumptions to any specific sets, we think the board should keep the confirm the proposal in the ED that it should be based on the most significant actuarial assumptions. We do note that, of course, that's going to be subject to materiality as well. On the quantitative range of the sensitivity, the issue is if we set the quantitative range for the analysis, it might improve comparability. However, that might not be indicative of what the reasonable possible change would be. On the other hand, if we go the same route as the exposure draft, users are going to have to extrapolate a given sensitivity in order to get comparative numbers. So either way, they're going to extrapolate in order to achieve one use. However, what we have recommended is the board keep the ED proposal to require the sensitivity on what is the most reasonably possible. at the end of the period. That's consistent with, because that's consistent with current requirements in IFRS 7. Moving on to demographic assumptions.
I think we should stop there, Manuel. Just deal with this bit first, because we've had quite an introduction there, and I don't want to sort of be forgotten and have to come back and do it again. in the sense that we should just kill this off while we're here. Pat?
I agree with the staff's recommendations in question 1A and B, but I disagree with the staff's recommendation to remove the disclosure of how the effect of the change in actuarial assumptions would affect the current service cost. The service cost is determined based on assumptions at the beginning of the period. And those assumptions are prerogative. So I think that the sensitivity analysis gives a user a sense of how the cost might have varied if management had made different reasonable choices. So I think it's more a measurement uncertainty disclosure than it is a sensitivity disclosure. It may have been in the wrong place in the exposure draft. It may not have been explained well in the exposure draft. But I think it is an important disclosure to help users understand the variability of the current period service cost.
Manuel, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, this goes back to what I was talking about, what the objective is, and I don't think it was that clear in the exposure draft. However, I do think that the objective is sensitivity to communicate what the risk is. Having that sensitivity done for the service cost, which is determined at the beginning of the period, isn't really going to be helpful in determining what the sensitivity is at the end of the period for service costs going forward. And I think that's why we've gone the way we have, I guess.
That's panel 19. Okay, it was Philip and then Steve.
I do support the staff proposals. However, on question 1A, I would like to understand more precisely how people are going to apply in practice this new concept of risks which are specific to the entity or unusual. Unusual in comparison to what? In comparison to an entity located in another jurisdiction. So I am based in Antarctica. Everyone in Antarctica has a special requirement regarding DBO that is unusual, but everyone has the same. So it is not specific to the entity, it is specific to the jurisdiction. But it might be seen as very unusual by an investor who is not based in Antarctica, because it differs from other jurisdictions. So what is the criteria here to make disclosures? It is unusual in comparison to the rest of the world, or to what you would expect in general? Second question, entity specific. Everyone in the same industry has more or less the same type of obligation. However, I differ from that. So clearly I am entity specific. Now the industry is specific. How would you say that, because you should know the industry, so you don't expect a special disclosures, or because you know, it's a question, how do you measure this specificity or this unusual feature?
I think that's a valid point, Philip, but I guess the difficulty is we don't think it's really going to be that helpful for entities to be disclosing every single risk that they're exposed to.
So I agree with that.
We think it should be limited, but it's finding that balance or even a limit, the set that it should be limited to, and setting an appropriate scope and policing that scope, I think.
Maybe we should frame it in the context of being in an international world where some reporters, some issuers might believe, because in their jurisdiction everyone has the same feature, so they are not unusual, so they will not disclose anything. But they should think of investors who might be from a different jurisdiction and might find it unusual. So I think we should probably give a little bit more guidance in the way they should behave in applying this new concept.
Okay, so you deal with the materiality and the unusual feature of that situation that help paint the picture. Steve, are you next?
Yeah, I was going to make the same point, actually. I question whether this is really going to be workable in the format it is, and you know, how much of an exhaustive search does somebody have to put in to determine whether what they're doing is unusual for companies? I mean, what would you anticipate would be the disclosure for longevity risk for a company? Do we say, well, all subject to longevity risk, therefore we don't have to say anything about it? What about situations where there's risk sharing, so part of the longevity risk is passed on to the employees? What if that becomes more common? So who's going to do the disclosure? I just couldn't work out how it would really work in practice. I mean, I agree with the objective that we need to find a way of avoiding all sort of voluminous disclosures which aren't necessary and try and focus on what really is necessary, but I'm not sure that those words do it.
I have questions related to the last recommendations, that is about the future payments over 5 years. And the paragraph 56 lay down the major reasons why people don't like it.
Sorry, we're not there. We're only at 27. We go. Haven't gone that far yet. No, we didn't do the whole paper. We stopped.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, we'll come to that. No,
hold your horses.
Okay, any other comments? Well, can I just put the question first of all, and Pat's queried C, but if I take it in the round, who would agree with the recommendations in question one? If that doesn't work, we'll go through them A, B, C individually, okay?
So subject to what Philip and
Pat are talking about. So, those in favour? Okay, that's Pat's... the one against. We can move on now to the next situation. I forgot to mention, I've been asked by Catherine to say that we're going to be bused to the dinner tonight. The bus was coming here at 5:30 and I've suggested, in fact, it comes at 5:15 so we can go back to the hotel and dump the stuff off so you don't have to take all your bags and everything with you, if that's okay. So we want to try and finish this by 5:15.
Take your ties off as well.
Yeah. He can faintly slip down.
If you want to be scruffy. Okay. Sorry. I've just done that figuring.
Thank you, Steve. Thanks for reminding me.
But it's going to appear as you did on the plane, okay?
Yeah. It's cold out there. It's British.
Okay, thanks. Moving on to the demographic assumptions. We got a lot of pushback on that. I think the staff agrees with the views in the comment letters that disclosing the process used to determine the demographic assumptions, such as mortality, would not help address the concerns the board has about the providing quantitative demographic assumptions and how that would be difficult for users to interpret that information. We don't think that providing details of how those amounts were derived would help users any further in interpreting those disclosures. Consequently, we recommend that the board drop that disclosure. Similarly, for the alternative measure of the defined benefit obligation, the board proposed that an entity disclose the DBO without the effect of future salary increases. A lot of respondents stated that this disclosure wasn't appropriate to have an alternative measure being disclosed, and they didn't quite see how useful it would be.
Are you jumping from question two to question three now?
Yeah. I'm just powering through Pete here. So, people didn't think it would be useful in many situations. They thought it would only be relevant in certain specific times, for instance, when an entity is going to be winding up the plan. However, some did suggest that instead of disclosing an alternative measure that entities should be disaggregating the defined benefit obligation into its constituent parts. We agree with that view. We think that will help explain the amount of the defined benefit obligation that's recognized in the financial statements a lot better. It would also be flexible. It will allow entities to tell the story of the DBO by letting them split it up into the components that's built up to that amount, whether they are future salary increases, unvested benefits, conditional indexation, or whatever. Therefore, we recommend a disaggregation on that basis. Information about asset liability matching strategies, the board proposed in the exposure draft that an entity should disclose information about asset liability matching strategies. There were mixed views on this proposal. A lot of people saw the link between this and the risk disclosures that we discussed earlier. However, there were concerns that the disclosure might be a bit boilerplate. People thought that the numbers in the disclosures on the plan assets and the DBO and the assumptions surrounding those, that they should be able to get a user to understand better what the risk management is. And there were some concerns that requiring this disclosure might imply that an entity should be doing asset liability matching. We do think that we recommend that the board maintains the disclosure. We think it's quite important for an entity to tell the story of how it's managing the risks that arise from its defined benefit obligation, especially in terms of the investment strategy that the entity has adopted in its plan assets and how it aims to match the amount and timing of cash flow of the liability with the plan assets. The last disclosure this paper discusses is the disclosure in paragraph 125K of the exposure draft, which proposed that entities disclose a narrative discussion of factors that could cause contributions to differ significantly from current service costs over the next 5 years. Many people didn't support the disclosure. They were unsure what the objective was. Respondents noted that there are many arbitrary factors that could cause contributions to differ from service costs, and disclosing those arbitrary factors isn't going to be particularly useful. But they noted that there is often no direct relationship between contributions and service costs. The funding requirements in each jurisdiction are different, and they're not based on the same requirements as the measurement of service costs. They also noted that the disclosure really considers funded plans, and they thought that's something that considers unfunded plans and also plans that are closed would be better. I think the staff agrees that the disclosure of the factors that would cause contributions to differ from current service costs would be unlikely to provide relevant information. We have identified two disclosures that might be better in providing what we think that the board was trying to, what the objective of the original disclosure was, and that is to provide information about the types of funding arrangements and the funding policy of the entity, and information about the amount of expected contributions and benefit payments in the future. In our opinion, these disclosures would be more relevant to financial statement users in identifying the risks around changes in contributions and forecasting, how much cash flow will be affected, based on the current funding of the scheme. Therefore, we recommend that the board require disclosure of the funding arrangements and the funding policy and the amounts of expected benefit payments over the next 5 years and the expected contribution in the next year.
Okay. Can we start with question two, which is on page 13, after 534? There wasn't much support for the process to work this out. It seems a strange question when you look at it. Does anyone object to the removal of this?
Yes. Well, I think this disclosure is very sensible to have it, especially if I remember correctly the discussion we had at the time of exposure trial about the mortalities and different. If it's a multinational with the different jurisdictions, it's very important to indicate what standard tables they used and when those standard tables were compiled by that particular authority. Now, by removing this, you're going to lose a lot of information, in my mind. I'm coming out of my self-imposed exile on talking about disclosures, but all I want to tell you is that I think this is a very sensitive disclosure. And, you know, I'll tell you this, when I went to Nigeria, I was surprised to know that their average life expectancy is 47 years. And I'm 2 years from now, I'm going to die, according to Nigerian standards. And I need to know that. I need to know whether that is changing. I'm not going to talk about disclosures, especially for more disclosures, but I really think this is a sensible disclosure we have, and we need to tell people how they got it.
Have we picked up in one of the earlier requirements about focusing on particular risks?
I don't know whether
people will be that specific, though.
In that example, PK, would you be more interested in what the mortality assumptions are, or how they have been derived?
Yes.
So ideally, both. But at least I would like to know how they have been derived and whether the management is sitting and conjuring up numbers, or is it like, you know, using some tables, and what is the currency of those tables would be very helpful, even if it's not a discussion for me. It forces companies to really think through, I'm telling you.
Wouldn't the helpful auditor make sure all that happened?
Let's not talk about auditors, okay? Just back off.
wouldn't you just get some bog standard disclosure? I looked up actuarial tables or something. I mean, the real question is, for every year that you deduct from the life expectancy in the UK, adds 4% to the obligation. So it really matters. That's why I've always been quite strong on how you're going to define it. You know, even if you look at the mortality risks in the UK, a man at 65 should live 19 years. Jan will live an extra 3. In America, you only live 18 years because of the hamburgers, but your wife lives an extra 3. In France, for some reason, probably because of red wine, you live 23 years, and being an egalitarian society, your wife pops off at the same time. Something's wrong with all that.
I think it's got to stop in France, isn't it?
What is wrong?
So, red wine.
You know, I think I don't understand the process. I think the process can be boilerplate, but you know, I've always felt quite strongly on the demographic assumption is probably one of the most important ones you've got. Paul?
But the point Manuel made is the disclosure of the assumption is required. This issue is, do we say we got it from government table developed in 1987?
I think it's
important. Well, I'm supporting his proposal. I just...
Yeah, well, you are. If that's in the footnote that says I got it from the American assumption from the whatever health department proposal and tables and the French one from the French government table, what does that add to already saying for my French employees I've assumed 23 years and the Americans 18, etc.?
Yeah, but it's very helpful though, Paul, because it tells the readers whether the management bases assumptions from the tables that have been published by an authority. I tell you this, though, in many developing nations, they have tables. Okay.
Well, then what will they answer here?
I want them to tell that they got a data which is very old and how they got to the process.
Does anyone else support PK?
No.
Can I just give you some background? Because I was the main driver behind it. So I think what ended up in the ED was a sort of mangled version of what I pushed for originally. And my concern is that the mortality assumption by itself is probably useless and possibly misleading, and possibly dangerously misleading. But I saw something in the process area as a substitute for the mortality assumption, not something in addition to it. Now, clearly, from the responses, people didn't get the process points of it, so I think that's the good point in keeping that. But it was as a substitute, not as an addition.
And what were you after, Peter?
What would you like to say?
Seems to me that there are different elements that you can disclose separately. And I think a critical assumption is the rate of mortality improvements. You were citing the UK experience. At the moment, mortality improves by about 4 months every year in the UK at the moment.
That's encouraging.
So that, knowing what people put in for that, I think is a useful disclosure, and I think you can usefully give that one. I think you can usefully disclose whether they are using up-to-date tables or not. One of the examples that was given to us once was apparently there were no Korean life tables at the time, so people just used Japanese ones instead as the nearest alternative. And I think that kind of information might be useful as well. But my concern about the sort of absolute level of the mortality assumptions is that you can't really tell whether that's aggressive or pessimistic unless you know an awful lot more about the demographics. And I don't see anywhere we can give enough disclosure to give people the demographic information.
So if you know about the Korean Japan, what do you do about it?
It's easy now, you have to do something.
I think if you give the disclosures of what the assumptions are, investors tend to do their analysis on a comparative basis. So they're going to be looking at other companies in that country or in that sector or in that industry. And if they're different, then it at least gives them a basis to have a conversation with management about the differences and what creates them. If there's no disclosure of the assumptions at all, there's no basis on which to have a conversation. So you can't say to the management of Company A, you know, how are, you know, your mortality assumptions versus your peers, because he will legitimately say, I have no idea what my peers are doing. And doesn't make any difference what I'm doing. I'm doing the right thing, right? So and so you can't have a conversation. So if you've got comparative analysis, you can at least have the conversation.
Is that your point, Paul?
Well, no. My point was we ought to, and I think we have, even in current 19 principles that say your actuarial assumptions should be up to date and relevant to your employee base. And isn't that a good enough principle to have without saying tell us which country tables you used? Just say it's relevant and up to date.
Steve.
I agree with Paul on that, so I agree that we shouldn't disclose the process, but I agree with Pat that, and disagree with Peter, I think we should disclose the numbers. If the rate of improvement is a valid disclosure, then why not the number itself? I mean, surely they're very similar. It seems to me that we have other situations where we disclose a number, you know, the useful life of a fixed asset. I mean, how are you going to use that without some detailed knowledge of the qualities of the asset? It's the same thing with longevity. The UK has had a non-mandatory encouraged disclosure of longevity assumptions now for quite a few years, and although it's non-mandatory, it's been pretty successful. I think over half the FTSE 100 companies provide this disclosure. And I think that the ASB staff regarded it as quite a success, that particular encouraged disclosure. It seems to work quite well. The disclosures have been done, in a fairly simple way. Life expectancy for a male age 60 is whatever, female, rate of improvements. But it's been done with sufficient detail to achieve an element of comparability and give people a sense of how aggressive or not companies are being in this disclosure. So I would just not differentiate between longevity and the other assumptions and require disclosure about longevity assumption the same way we do the interest rate assumption?
Well, I think we do at the moment. We just say you need to disclose. The proposal in the disclosure draft was to eliminate the list of actuarial assumptions that require disclosure and just say if an assumption is significant to the DBO, then you should disclose it.
So it's there. So Peter's concern. So is there already? Is it?
My concern was that it might be misleading. But I mean, you know, clearly the alternative proposed in the ED didn't right. hit the target. So I think we obviously have to drop that.
Okay, I certainly think the demographic assumption plus the interest rate assumptions are the two biggest in this. You can completely change everything by that. Okay, those who would agree with the recommendation, question two.
Yeah, okay,
everyone. All right, PK makes it unanimous. Well done, PK. Yeah, good team player. Cool. Yeah. Okay, question three. This was the one where we give up the extension and instead of break up the actual number. So you still get it, but it's as part of the overall number. Steve?
Well, my question is, what's the difference? I mean, if you're disclosing vested, unvested, so I can cue, you say vested benefits, unvested benefits, future salary increases. They're not three separate things, are they? There's vested, unvested, presumably adds up to the total, and then there's PBO, ABO.
I think the principle is to provide some sort of disaggregation of the DBO based on what it comprises.
But if we decided that disaggregating out the salary growth bit wasn't such a good idea,
well, it's not going to be.
Then why introduce it again?
It's not going to be a good idea in all circumstances. We're saying we're not picking on the future growth salaries in isolation. You can provide a disaggregation on whatever factor is material or significant to that DBO. So we're not being specific in picking on. We just want to see. Salary growth. You can break the number down however best fits the circumstances.
And however best fits, how do you want to interpret that?
I'm
not sure. You know, if I were looking at this as a company, I wouldn't know. Well, what am I supposed to do here? What is the best disaggregation in my particular circumstances? Well, I don't really know, so I better play safe and I'll give all of them.
Yeah.
Can I just ask the exact question this too? If, for example, the DBO is 100, but the accrued obligation is 80, would this disclosure say something like future salaries 20, vested benefits 70, unvested 10? So we're just going to, you're going to give the same number as we've said we don't need separately. It's just as part of the whole. That's all you're going to give. Can they do that one? Yeah, I suppose they can.
I think we should test this before we put it in a final. And we need to go out, ask the advisory group, ask some of the people that responded to the ED. I think this could be quite a big issue and might get a lot of pushback on it. I'm not saying it's not a good idea.
Yeah.
I like the idea of disaggregation, but I think we'll get some pushback.
Should we go ahead on that basis?
Yeah.
Matching strategies now, that's question four after 53. Any comments? Do we agree with the recommendation? Nobody disagree? Okay. And the final question. Is this where you wanted to come in?
Yes. Now, the staff proposed to replace the original proposed disclosure with the ones in A and B. But I'm not sure whether, you know, such kind of forecasted amount is in line with our general directions or related to the forecasted information. And secondly, whether you discuss with our constituency, especially working group members, this is doable or not. And finally, if we really think these kind of informations are useful, I would like to see the analysis of the possible factors which may affect the future changes. I'm not sure whether, my first question is whether to provide future information is in line with the basic ideas.
In answer to the first question about providing information about the future, I think the amount of expected contributions in the next year is currently required in IS19 anyway. So we're actually just maintaining what's in there. In terms of the benefit payments over the next 5 years, you're required to project forward the benefits in order to do the measurements. So I think that's still okay because you're required to do it anyway. And this is just disclosing that information.
But I think it is different because last week we had another meetings. I'm not sure which ones because we have too many meetings. One of the participants said to provide a measure based on different assumption is one story, and provide the basis is another story.
But this is just asking you to describe what you're doing, basically. This is on the basis B is something you should have calculated anyway, because that's part of your obligation. And A is simply saying what's the arrangements that you're running.
Yeah, A,
I think we need to be a bit careful, actually, on the expected benefits over the next 5 years, because what you have to do anyway is the benefit payments for the existing obligations, but of course it's not benefit obligations for future service. You don't have to calculate that because it's not in the calculation. So we need to be quite careful what it is we want to require there.
It's just all parcels.
Right. Yeah, it's not clear though. Well, it depends what the wording is in the agenda or what should be proposed to say.
Yeah. I mean, this was one of my concerns about this area when we were first developing this for the ED, that just disclosing the future cash payments is a bit odd in a way because some of it does relate to future service and some of it does relate to past service. And we just need to be very careful, I think, what the objective is when we're trying to disclose.
Yeah, this is why I said if we do think it is useful and we require, then analysis of the factors which may impact the future changes will be much more useful if you do want to provide future information.
That was the basis behind what was in the ED, really, but clearly, again, that was one that this one just didn't really get, I think, so clearly didn't work in the form we had it there.
And what do you propose, Peter?
I think something along these lines is probably useful, a description of the funding, because I think that's probably more useful than trying to reduce it to a number. And then some sort of analysis, some sort of maturity analysis or something of that kind, but I think we need to be careful about whether it is the future cash amounts, and that opens the concerns that Wego expressed about forecasts, or whether it's just the maturity schedule of what's already included in the liability.
That's fair.
So what is, I do not understand regarding the B, we will get rid of the benefit payment of 5 years?
I think as Michael said, that they'll have to calculate to the extent it's talking about benefit payments that are in the existing liability. But then if we have that...
That payment is from the pension fund, I think. No, not the entity itself, but it depends on the unfunded or unfunded. But in case of the unfunded, it has some meanings. But in case of the funded, I think it's related to the fund, and I'm not quite sure whether it's useful or not.
I have the same feeling that if the plan is funded, the disclosure makes sense only if you show at the same time what is available in the plan to cover the payments. Otherwise, you surely, because we are not reporting separately the assets and liabilities, we're reporting the net position. To talk about one element of the net position without looking at what is available to cover the out payments doesn't make sense.
Steve and then Pat.
I agree with Philippe, actually. I think if it's a fully funded scheme, for example, and might be, you know, a mature scheme, massive compared with the size of the company, disclosing five very large payments which are going to be made to the pensioners is completely irrelevant when you have assets available and you're simply going to sell the assets to fund the payments. I don't see whether the payments are big or small has any relevance as far as the sponsor is concerned. Now, if it's unfunded, it's different. If there is a asset liability mismatch, if there's difference in duration of the asset, of course, all of those are relevant. But the actual payment itself, I just don't see that that's a relevant number when it's funded, as Tansen was saying.
I think it can be useful information, even in a funded plan. It may be that the payments in the next 5 years are going to use significantly all of the assets in the plan. It helps a user predict what the future contributions might be, because it gives them an idea of the maturity analysis of the obligation and helps them figure out the duration of the obligation, or tenor, I guess, is the new correct term. So I think that disclosure can be very useful, and the assets are disclosed in the footnote that are there, that are available. So
by liquidity, but not by liquidity. So it's matching of the liquidity, the liquidity of the liquidity of the assets that is important. I mean, we have a mismatch in terms of liquidity, but we are not disclosing very much in terms of liquidity for the assets, aren't we?
What we finally got disclosed.
We don't disclose a maturity analysis on the assets, but we do require disaggregation of the plan assets, a disaggregation that best reflects the underlying liquidity and other risks.
Well, look, I have my plan asset, I have a building in the center of Paris. Okay, important to know it. Whether it is liquid or not, and whether I can make cash out of it in the next 2 years, and I don't know, if I don't ask management about any information, then I may have a big payment out of the fund. I may be able to sell this building, or may not be able to sell it, depending on the circumstances, to match my payment. So I think only the net liquidity position really makes sense from the user's perspective, in my view, not a gross position.
Can we take this question in parts? Does anyone disagree with E? Does anyone disagree with the expected contribution next year?
Disagree?
I don't disagree strongly. I don't think it's very informative. We already give the contribution for the current year in the reconciliation. I don't disagree strongly. I don't think it'll add much.
The only problem I have is that whether it fits a forecast somehow, then how do you... There will be prospect information, and
Have you been an auditor?
But Peter said that we need to know, be very clear whether what kind of payments are we talking for the next 5 years.
This is one's already required, isn't it?
Yep. Yeah.
So we've had this for years now.
Payment.
Yeah. The contribution for
next year.
The employer's contribution for the one next year.
Okay. So who disagreed with that? Okay, who probably, no, it's Peter who wrote the, what about the benefit payments thing? This is the one where we're having the discussion. What were you recommending, Peter?
I think the thing that is consistent with the paper, it doesn't express it that clearly, probably is that it's a maturity analysis of the benefit payments for current and past service, not for future service, for the next 5 years. So is that what the intention was?
I think so, yeah.
Current and future.
Say it again.
Current and past.
So you've got your liability is 1,000, and of that, 500 is going to be paid out in the next 5 years. And so you disclose that 500 by year.
Should we talk about duration as well?
Yeah, if you want to.
Yeah, because can we just jump over to to agenda paper 11G? Because this is a related disclosure
for page.
It's
This is the UPA again.
It's paragraphs 5 to 9 of agenda paper 11G, which talks about disclosing the duration of the defined benefit obligation.
This is from the UK plan.
This is disclosure that's currently in the UK ASB reporting statement. A lot of people suggested that it is a useful disclosure. It's the weighted average time of that the liability is going to be mature over. We think that this type of disclosure, the disclosure of the duration, would complement people's understanding of how the maturity of the obligation in the balance sheet, but also the disclosure of the discount rate in determining where on the yield curve it sits. This is quite similar to the benefit payments disclosure, except instead of looking at it as a series of payments, it's a summary statistic of what the average duration of that liability is. So perhaps that might be a better way of helping users understand what the maturity is instead of requiring the maturity analysis of the actual payments.
Jan, do you want to
question? A question then. What is your expected answer on a question like this? It's about 25, 30, 35 years?
Yeah.
So I mean,
yeah,
what do you do with that information? It's 28 years average maturity.
Well, it lets you know how far into the future, on average, you're going to be, that obligation is going to last. It will help you understand the liquidity. For instance, if you had a shorter average duration, you'd look closer at the plan assets as well to make sure that you've got the assets to match that duration. So it is a summary statistic, so it's not going to be as helpful as, you know, the complete maturity analysis of payments, because it's not going to give you that level of granularity. But it is going to convey some information about what the duration of the liability is expected to be.
Is that some part of the discussion of the asset liability strategies, management strategies, matching strategies? Because obviously the asset liability management strategy would be based on the average duration of the liability.
I thought it was part of that.
That's proportion.
Just ignoring Phil.
Because both the benefits, the suggestion in paragraph 62 of agenda paper 11F and this suggestion in paper 11G, they're both talking about the expected cash flows that the DBO. However, they're looking at it from two different perspectives. One's looking at what the analysis of the cash is going to be in the future, and one's just summarising that into a single statistic.
I'm wondering if maybe we should take the detail of this discussion offline, but maybe get a sense from the board of whether you think some disclosure in this area would be a good idea.
That's a good idea, Ben.
And also, Manuel, relate to this one, I would like to see the actual examples, know, the used, published in UK's annual report.
For the information?
Yes, and also you say users feel particularly useful, interested in. Do you have any evidence?
Well, for instance, the users on the employee benefits working group suggested this. And I think, I'm not sure if... which users it was in the comment letters, but I think there was someone else in the comment letters that suggested this as well.
This is the duration you're talking about.
Duration, yeah.
do we seem to feel that the certainly the duration would be something that we ought to explore moving forward? There's an indication. What does the US and the UK do on your first recommendation, the one that was in the other paper, you said the 5 years or whatever, what do they do for that?
I think the US discloses the expected benefit payments over the next 5 years.
Which is what you recommend.
However, I'm not quite sure whether that's for past service only or whether it's for both past and future service.
I think it's just past service.
I think it's past service.
I think it's just past service.
And the UK, does it do anything?
I don't think so.
No.
Well, we should look at the US one just to make sure exactly what it does say.
Yeah, that's the reason I'm trying to say. Otherwise, it becomes a prospective financial information,
and it
gets into a different realm of.
But there is some requirements under US GAAP for the disclosure of the future benefits. But I'm not exactly sure what the.
Well, why don't we check that out and bring that back?
And I think we'll look separately at funded and unfunded as well. We make sure that whatever we come up with is both.
But there is general support, I
think. So, yeah, general support for doing something in this area, but we just need to sort of check it out. Okay.
Do you think we'll have to bring it back then?
Maybe do it, circulate it and see if we've got a problem.
Yeah.
Okay, and I think that's another one we just want to test out when you send it to a working party or whatever you do. Okay, can we finish with, what was it? Are you still okay, Jay Ho? Are you sticking in there? Sorry about this, it's 25 past 8, Jay Ho, so let's let him get off the bed.
11, Jay, we've already talked about the duration. We'll move over to...
I'd assume that we've read it. You just give the main points.
Mark. Yeah. Requiring disclosure of additional information to meet the objectives. I think we'll have other proposals out there at the moment have suggested that, so we'll probably end up doing the same, but we'll keep an eye out on what feedback we receive. On the disaggregation of plan assets, there was a bit of pushback on that. A lot of people objected to having the specific categories in the disclosure requirements. People thought that we should concentrate more on what the objective is, that an entity should disaggregate the plan assets into a class that determines the risk and liquidity characteristics. We agree with that. We think we should probably move to example sets of categories that better illustrate that objective. In terms of the categories themselves, people had problems with distinguishing between government and other, when government is not necessarily a better credit quality than other. So we think distinguishing between the different credit qualities is probably going to be better and better illustrating what the principle of the disclosure is. There were some concerns about distinguishing between quoted and unquoted. However, I think this was a watered-down version from what we originally had, which was quite closely correlated to what fair value is proposing, the three levels. We recommend the board keep the quoted versus unquoted. And I think that was it. Does anyone have any comments on those ones?
Again, what does the US do in this area?
The US requires disaggregation based on the are you talking about the plan assets?
Yeah.
Yep. They have an example set of categories. They have quite an extensive set of example categories that they use. But their principle is quite close to what ours is. And on the in terms of the quoted unquoted, they actually use the fair value hierarchy for that, which I guess we could potentially do, but we thought about it and we thought it's probably not worth people doing it in the run up to the exposure draft. So we just said the quoted and unquoted. So I think.
So the US doesn't have a list of minimum asset categories that must be disclosed?
If you look at...
I've probably read it and forgot it.
It was paragraph 26.
26B, it's on page 9.
What worries me in this is state the principle and give examples. What are we going to see?
It's 20.
Yep. What was it?
Paragraph 20.
Okay. That's got to be. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. What the worry is that if you don't list a minimum number of categories, you think this is crucial information, you're going to see as much as you should. Are people going to take this as an opportunity to minimise the disclosures in an unacceptable way? That's the worry you've got. It's a trade-off. I understand that if you list a minimum number of categories, then there's a chance that it may not be consistent with the principle. If you just state a principle and say, here's some examples, you may not get very much at all.
If you look at the list that's in paragraph 20,
pretty
it's
big.
Far more detailed than required for the entity's own assets.
Yeah, they're examples, aren't they? They're not that's not minimum. In 20.
Yeah.
That's the difference, Peter, whereas we've got a minimum number of categories you must disclose.
But often pension assets are greater than the entity's own assets.
Yeah. I just have some nervousness about this.
Is paragraph 20 effective? Do you get that number of categories?
In the US GAAP, you mean?
Yeah.
This is relatively new.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Statement 158, right?
Yeah. Yes. But it's still people do that, and I don't know how much it goes pages and pages, but people do disclose that, and it's quite effective to show which what type of assets they have.
There's nothing in SEC requirements here that might know.
I don't think so. There's any SEC requirement here. It's completely dictated by the...
No, I would prefer the FSB's approach to principles and examples, because you require minimum items, but it is not applicable to a particular entities. It really depends on...
Depends how broad your minimums are. I think cash will probably be applicable to most of them.
Could be a material.
Could be, yeah. More materiality applies anyway.
Sorry.
Only one
question. What would be the concept of high quality?
Sorry?
You're suggesting that you replace the disaggregating into high quality debt and other debt. What would be high quality?
Well, I think that the point was to disaggregate based on the credit rating rather than whether the issuer was governments or non-governments.
You not always have raised
problem.
Instruments
in many countries.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a similar concept of high quality.
Yeah,
I have a similar concern, you know. Last year we had ED on discount rates. We failed. One reason is because different countries have different benefits.
The other disaggregation might not be, let's say, fair to represent the risks associated with them, but at least is more objective than defining high quality, having us defining what is high quality.
Well, I don't think perhaps making the distinction high quality and non-high quality isn't the best way. It's more about distinguishing between different credit ratings of that debt. We could be more specific in that, credit rating or something, but I think that the distinction was, you know, the credit rating is what matters, because that's what we talk about in the objective about the risks and liquidity, rather than whether it's a government or non-government, because governments can have a low credit rating as well.
Yeah, and you know, it's. I think we are going to spend a lot, awful amount of time, looking for a definition of high quality. That's my. I've experienced some similar issue before.
But I think, Amaro, they're proposing a disaggregation based on credit quality, something like that. And maybe if you just word it that way, that will
even
do.
Most
regulators of pension funds already, maybe they specify minimum levels of quality that a pension fund can even invest in.
So should we leave this to the regulators, is your proposal?
No, I would say high quality. I'm agreeing with you. Don't say high quality, but just say an example disaggregating by credit quality, something like that.
Could be.
And then they can develop such
a system. But not defining that.
Without defining what is high quality, medium quality, or low quality.
If we say credit quality, then we should say broad categories, because if you want people to have 25 lines to by notch of rating, then that could become very, very granular. So let's say by broad categories of credit quality.
But Manuel, you're not proposing to put this in the standard, are you, the high quality? This is just the way in which you illustrate it in the example?
Yes. If we go down the example approach, because the objective is to disaggregate to distinguish between the categories that have different risk and liquidity characteristics, one of those examples would be the credit rating of the insurance.
And how many categories are you proposing to put in the example?
Well, we'll probably keep the same ones that we have,
which
as
is
a minimum.
Four, isn't it?
But we could expand them. If they're example ones, we could draw on.
Just looking at the FASB list, which is...
More. Quite a bit, actually.
I like the principle plus what the FASB has done with that list, I think.
The only thing that worries about the FASB list, which is, you know, by industry type, company size, investment, national, you get huge.
But is that a minimum list then? You have to start with that and then go more? But
they're just examples.
I mean, I agree the industry, that's sort of giving the breakdown of the portfolio.
But the thing that I'm worried about here is one side, it talks about whether you need additional ones or further disaggregation. It doesn't say whether you need further aggregation. You know, it's gone one way. Which sounds as if this is a minimum, you need more. And it's huge. We'll get pages and pages and pages of this stuff.
It actually shows, the people show pages and pages.
Well, is that helpful?
No.
Well, it shows that if I have bonds in the state of California, I would be scratching my head.
Yes.
So it's an example in that sense of the word.
That's okay for U.S. companies, but we're talking multinationals. This could be huge.
Especially if you have Greek debt, then, or Irish debt.
This really worries me. I go back to your point, Pete, that sometimes, you know, the assets of the plan may be bigger than the assets of the company, yet we have in IS-1, we have a list of minimum categories, budgets and liabilities we have to disclose. I don't like moving away from... I mean, we've had in IS-19 the requirement to disclose a minimum number of asset categories.
I'm looking at...
Bear in mind materiality applies here. If it's not appropriate, then, you know, it's not applicable because it's simply material, you don't show it.
What does IBM say?
It was curious, you know, because they obviously have a large DB plan and they have 15 categories, more or less along the lines of the minimum list that has been provided. So it's pretty comprehensive.
Yeah, that's what I do.
Okay, well, the recommendation is to drop the minimum list and to do something presumably on the FASB lines, is that right?
Yeah, yes.
Okay, who supports that proposal?
David.
Who support?
Not half.
Do you support it?
Yeah. All of it.
Vote
with me, wait, what?
Could I see that? Who supports the FASB proposal? We just sort of put something.
I think Weber is just trying to clarify whether we're voting on parts of a specific question here or.
Yeah, my idea is principle and examples, but not limit only the Amaro mentioned high quality or not. You intend to give only two examples. That is high quality or not. I don't like the idea. Because if you give these two as examples, people just follow these two examples.
Okay, can we just take a jumble two questions together there? What about just saying who wants to get rid of the proposed list? Who would like to get rid of the list, the minimum list?
I'd like
because it's going to be principles versus examples. That's the alternative. Principles versus examples versus minimum list. That's the choice. And then we can decide what you want in your...
You can't have both. Principles plus example.
Yes, of course, minimum. Principles.
Yeah, you can have four principles if you want. Yeah.
Principles.
Great,
I'm ready.
Principles plus minimum.
The principles and the examples.
Yes. That's one way of dealing with it. Or do we have a minimum list of staff recommendations?
So
we get
rid of that. You have a minimum list and you can have an example.
Okay, the staff is proposing the principles with examples,
Yes.
Or you can have a minimum list with some examples.
Let's just take one thing at a time. Who believes we must retain a minimum list? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Luke is lost. Right, okay, we're not having a minimum list. So we're now into principles versus examples. Okay, let's see who could support that.
Principles and examples.
So we're now led about examples.
Yeah, you will have it again.
And the examples would be a minimum list.
And then, so that's what we're going to do. It's principles and examples. Yeah. And the question is, you better have a look at what we should do. I don't want to start going through it here. Who would like something on the lines of the FASB one?
As the minimum list. As the example.
Take the paragraph. You know, they've given the examples of things you should. But who would like to see something like that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay. Try that. I think you should test it on. We need to test all these because people complain furiously about them for you. Yeah. Okay. Is that us done with these disclosures now? Oh, sorry, what about the first one? They've done the duration, the stand-back requirement. That almost goes without saying, doesn't it? You always have to have that. Nobody object? Okay, we're done with that paper?
Yep, we're done with that.
Jeho, can you go home now? anything you want to add?
You can stay and listen if you wish.
I will stay.
Yeah. Oh, he'll stay.
He's a trooper.
So we all did that first for nothing.